Welcome to At Altitude. Many a team that has built up a big lead has learned this lesson the hard way. The quickest way to defeat is to try not to lose. Keeping our foot on the gas is a key premise of Accelerate, Change, or Lose. Better to keep piling up the points than wait until the competition slowly chips away at your lead to get rolling again. That is how things get very scary. Educating and empowering non-commissioned officers to act based on commander's intent and the situation on the ground is one of the ways a fighting force has the agility to gain a lead and keep it. Senior enlisted advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Ramon Colon Lopez, is walking proof that empowered enlisted personnel are a key to victory. He has earned many ribbons and medals during his storied career, much of which as a result of combat as a pararescue jumper, and then as commandant at the PJ School at Kirtland Air Force Base, and as command chief at the 1st Special Operations Wing at Hurlburt Field, and the 18th Wing at Kadena Air Force Base, as well as at Central Command. That chest full of fruit salad makes something perfectly clear. Colon Lopez has been there, he's done that, and he's done it well. If you want to know what impact a motivated and empowered NCO can have on the battlefield, or how the U.S. and its allies can not just maintain but stretch a lead over peer adversaries looking to mount a comeback, SEAC Colon Lopez would be one of the best people to ask. So we did. Join me now to hear what he has to say. I'm Joe Edens, and you are at Altitude.
All right, so good afternoon. I'm Ramon Colon Lopez, go by CC by a lot of people. Operator's initials, first and last letter of the last name, and I'm the current senior enlisted advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I am no longer a chief, the rank is actually SEAC.
All right, and so could you give people a little bit of background or understanding about what your scope of responsibility is?
Well, the scope of responsibility, to put it into Air Force context, is that I do not do what Joanne Bass does for the force. Joanne Bass has got Title 10 responsibilities, man, train, and equip for the United States Air Force. I collaborate, help her out on issues that pertain to the total force, not just the Air Force, to make sure that every single one of you troops are ready to go ahead and engage in the fight and that you have anything that you need to take care of yourselves and your family.
Could you speak a little bit to your LOEs and why each of them is important?
Well, so there's four of them, you know, and the first one is solidifying the position of the SEAC. Now, why is that important? Because the position of the SEAC is fairly new. It began in 2005 under General Peter Pace, and there have been two soldiers, one Marine, and an airman, and soon to be another Marine as the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, Troy Black, takes over in November as SEAC number 5. But because the position is so new, you still have to solidify the value of it. So my first year in the position was designed to do that, make sure that the policies align, the protocol, the inclusion in boards, bureaus, and working groups was solid, and to make sure that every single one of you, all 2.4 million of you, had a voice in key decision-making forums. And often that is only the SEAC that is invited to those meetings.
So could you tell me a little bit about your second LOE, which is about the joint force?
Yeah, so developing the joint force is really nested into every single strategic document for the United States and also the expectation of collaboration with partner nations. As we transition from counterinsurgency operations after 20 years in the Middle East, we need to shift the focus now on the way that the troops are going to fight against a near-peer competitor. We're talking about nuclear powers. We're talking about people that have very robust and exquisite technological capabilities to go ahead and combat us on an even playing field. So now we have to shift to the thinking method of employment of combat, and what is it that we need to do? What gaps did we identify over the past 20 years that the force needs to be able to be prepared to contend with a near-peer competitor?
All right. And so with that, I'm sure that all of that plays a role inside of the global partnerships part of your LOEs. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That is absolutely correct. So both the National Defense Strategy and the National Military Strategy state that in many occasions, we're going to have to rely on partners to be able to go ahead and carry the weight of the fight. And if you look at what's happening right now in the fight of Ukraine and Russia, that is really playing out to where we have a partner that is very capable, we're providing support, and they're going after one of those near-peer competitors that we have in our strategic documents. So by doing that, we have to ensure that we're sharing lessons learned with them because we're a highly capable military. And I will dare say that we're probably the most experientially focused and credible military in the world because of the conflicts that we have been involved in. So we continue to share these lessons with every single one of them to make sure that they're best prepared to contend with the people closest to their borders and for us to be in a supporting role. Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that we have our capabilities ready to go after the high-end fight. And that may not necessarily be going after every single conflict that occurs. Sometimes we may need to just empower our partners or support them to be able to carry that fight.
Mm-hmm. And another part of that support comes in the form of your fourth LOE, which is taking care of families. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I grew up in the special operations community, and that is our truth number one, that humans are more important than hardware. And as a department, we really need to do more to make sure that we take care of the human weapon system just like we take care of the weapon systems that are sitting on the ramp, in our ships, in our docks, and in the many other places that we have assets like tanks, missiles, and so on. So in order to do that, you have to make sure that number one, we have a robust supporting mechanism to take care of our people. Number two, that we have a robust mechanism to take care of our families. Because if the family life is not healthy, the member is not going to be healthy and combat effective. So it's an all-inclusive package to make sure that we do everything in our power to we continue to do the best support that we can and make a value proposition for every single one of our service members that being in the military is good.
So I kind of want to stay on that lane a little bit. I know I have some questions down the line just about your experiences and stuff, but how has your background being pararescue helped you better understand what it means to take care of your family and the families of those around you and why that is so critical to the health of the member that's accomplishing the mission?
Well, when you're gone, on average, 180 to 220 days out of the year, you get to see all of the issues that can surface when you're not taking care of your family. My wife grew to be very, very independent because I was seldom there. And what that means is that she took care of everything back home. And sometimes when I came home, I will try to change things and I will be shut down fairly quick because that was a method. And I got to learn that, hey, she's been pouring her heart and soul into the things that you haven't been doing while you're deployed. So respect what she has done. As a leader, that helped me understand that sometimes when you're working people hard in certain schedules, that you have to be open to that flexibility, to where something critical happens in that family, you have to allow them the time to be able to go ahead and take care of it. And part of that is not the opportunity for them to be able to go, but also create a relationship between you, the subordinate, and me as a supervisor, to let them know that don't be afraid to ask. And don't ask, tell me that these are the cut lines for your family, and if you need to be there, you must be there. And trust me, everybody can do that, because if one person out of the organization is gone for an hour or two to be able to go to a recital, a graduation, and so on, the department will keep on going in the same direction.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. So kind of backtracking a little bit, I wanted to ask you about your experience growing up inside of Connecticut and how you decided to make the jump to join the Air Force and what made you decide to take that leap.
Yeah. So my family was fairly poor, and we basically gave up everything that we have in Puerto Rico because we didn't have jobs. We came to Bridgeport, Connecticut. I lived in the middle of the ghetto, and it was between Pembroke Street and Hallett Street, and that's where most of the gangs were concentrated at the time. So it created a very challenging environment. Didn't really care much for it, to be honest with you. I'd rather be on the island with my childhood friends, but we had to do what we needed to do. So growing up in that environment, I went to my first semester of college still dissatisfied with my life. I was still living at home. I wanted some independence and I wanted some discipline. Recruiting station, passed it, turned back around, went back in. I felt it was the right place. The Air Force was the only one there, so here I am today. And I joked that the Air Force was the first, the only one there, but they made a great first impression. And it was Technical Sergeant Derek Reason that brought me in. And you hear all the horror stories about, you know, recruiters lie, they'll try to go ahead and get you to sign things that you don't want to do and everything else. That is not the impression that Derek Reason gave me. He laid it all on the line. He was very transparent and really coached me through the process, not sold me something. And the reason I remember his name is because of the impact that he made on me. And I remember writing him a letter when I graduated basic training, telling him thank you.
So with that, was your family supportive of your decision?
Absolutely not. They were not. And I think it's a very parental response to where if you put forth that you want to join a profession that is dangerous, their first answer is going to be no. Why do you want to do that? And I mean, you see it on commercials today, right? The mother following the kid, why do you want to do this? Why wouldn't you go to college, mom? Because I have a calling and everything else. Well, I didn't see any other option. I knew that I didn't want to stay in Bridgeport, get a job there and do what my peers were doing. I wanted to do something different. And I wanted to go ahead and come to my own on the decisions that I made in my life. You know, that I didn't want to be dependent on anyone but myself. I wanted to own my future. And it was very easy for me to tell them, I get it. I know that you have concerns, but trust me. I feel that this is what's best for me. And I wanted to take control of my life.
So I'm guessing at the narrative a little bit, but I know your first career field is not where you ended up. Can you tell me a little bit about that journey and what made you decide to become a pararescueman?
So remember that when I first came into serving, I wanted discipline and I wanted some independence in my life. And I didn't really care what duty I was given. I just wanted to get the hell out of Bridgeport. Right? So I enlisted and at basic training, they came up one day, and I'm pretty sure every airman that is sitting here right now is that day. So if somebody comes and say, hey, anybody wants to go to the swimming pool and try out for this thing, go ahead and do it. My English was pretty limited at the time. So I asked, I didn't really understand what this guy said, but what was that thing about P something and combat something? They're like, oh, don't worry about it. You won't make it through that. So I didn't go. A couple of my peers went, and from my 3711th BMTS training squadron, and they came back with their tail in between their legs. They didn't make it. I was just like, well, I'm glad I didn't go, you know, because they looked pretty beat down. So, you know, when I got into tech school, I went into traffic management. That was my AFSC. And I did that in Greece for a little bit, and I got an opportunity to deploy to Camp Doha, or not to Camp Doha, but to Eskam Village in Saudi Arabia. But I believe that it was at that very moment to where something clicked on me. I was like, wow. So I feel the worthiness of being deployed, doing something for my country, but I'm not fulfilled. I don't belong in the rear. I need to be in the front lines. And I think that that was the first part that I got, that you need to go ahead and change jobs if you want to get closer to the fight.
Yeah, so what kept you focused once you started the training to become a pararescueman? I saw online that your class started with 113 and then you graduated as one of 12.
Yes.
How do you stay resilient and focused throughout that long pipeline?
It's all about guts, and it's also about motivation. So I will tell you that negativity fueled my passion for success in the pararescue pipeline. I had 7 out of 8 people tell me that I was going to be one of those that came back with their tail in between their legs. I was about 150 pounds wet. I was basically a small frame guy. And they were just like, yeah, you know, that's for football players and so on. But what I noticed is, not a single one of those people that told me that I couldn't do it had put their mettle to the test. They had never tried to do it. So how dare they tell me what I can and cannot do? So I went in there with that attitude. You know, I'll show you. So made it through the pipeline. At the end of 2 years, I went to the one person that was the lead on that naysayer committee that told me that I wasn't going to make it. And I simply just put my beret on their table and I just said, thank you for the motivation. I appreciate it. And that was it. That's really what kept me going. People telling me that I couldn't do something where they had no right to tell me what I could and could not do.
How does that kind of passion and motivation still move you forward through your position as a SEAC?
It became a habit. It became a habit for life. You know, your mind, your heart, and your actions are almost like a club, a nightclub, and you hold that velvet rope. You choose who you let in. You have to make sure that you're very judicious on the things that you decide to pay attention to. I'm a fairly positive person. I look at the negative side of things just as a caution, but not as a behavior-shaping mechanism, which means that I tend to find the good in things and I tend to find a way to make things happen. So as the SEAC and throughout my career, I believe that it was those habits that eventually built my credibility to become who I am today. I never boasted for assignment or for position. I simply went where I was told to go and I made a difference. And I let that speak for myself when it came to the next opportunity that was gonna come out. Actions, not words, will drive your career.
And with that kind of thinking in mind, what advice would you give to the enlisted who are dealing with like a frozen middle or, you know, naysayers or people who don't think that their ideas are worth putting to the test or trying out as we, you know, are entering this era of, you know, accelerating change or lose and coming up against some pretty formidable adversaries?
Well, the one thing I know about the young generation that is coming into the United States Air Force specifically and across the services is that they're brilliant. They have a lot of great ideas. They're thinking clearly, panoramically. I hate saying thinking outside the box because that's a constraint on its own, but they're thinking panoramically about the things that could be the future. And you cannot lead with a closed mind. You cannot open opportunities with a closed mind. So you tend to listen to what your people are telling you. When you start looking at frozen middles and you look at caustic leadership or the status quo commandos, they need to step aside and they need to go ahead and open up their minds to what the future brings. Because there's a lot of things, even as a Generation Xer, that I do not understand about the next generation that comes after me. There's plenty of gaps that they can fill, and then I can put my experience in concert with their thoughts and motivation and make something great happen. That is really how you win wars. It's a generational commitment and everybody is a stakeholder in the decisions that need to be made.
So you hinted a little bit at your experience, right? I wanted to ask you about something that you said during this year's Air and Space Force symposium. Mm-hmm. And so you were talking about the importance in being intentional with the language that we use when we're talking about fighting the People's Liberation Army instead of the Republic of China. Can you speak a little bit to why that distinction is so important and where you've seen people kind of fall into that pitfall before?
Well, in today's communications environment, we tend to be generalists. And we always go ahead and put everybody in the same bubble, which is dangerous because not everybody's the same. After the September 11 attacks, the force thought they were fighting Muslims. And that is not the case because once they got into country, they figure out that there were some very strong allies that were Muslims here, even some of the Afghans that ended up getting into the Afghan military forces were great partners. I'm friends, lifelong friends with a lot of them. So I always caution people on generalizations because that can be dangerous. That can be dangerous. That can be very segregative in many ways. And it is better to understand really who the true enemy is so that way you can focus on that. If you focus on fighting the Chinese, are you fighting their economy? Are you fighting the people that just want to make a living? Does everybody in China agree with the PLA's response to any topic? And the answer is no. So why should you say that you're fighting the Chinese? Yeah, there may be Chinese in the PLA, but in essence, we're fighting a military entity. And that's how we keep the lines unblurred when it comes to our focus.
What is at stake if we don't focus on that?
Well, the pitfalls that we're seeing today. People speaking without the facts and making idiotic assumptions about many things not having all of the facts laid on the table. And the main thing that you get when you start pinpointing actually the root causes and the actual topics that you want to go ahead and discuss, and you start lining up with facts, you tend to have a more logical and intelligent conversation. When you start generalizing, sometimes you lose the bubble on what you're trying to say. And people can misinterpret different things. People can just go ahead and get misled to what you said. And it is very dangerous. So it is one of those habits that you need to build over time to be able to be pointed in your communication so that people clearly understand exactly what you said.
Yeah, so as we were sitting down to start the interview, you spoke a little bit about kind of balancing all the different forces and all the different needs, all the different conflicts or events that are happening across the world. When do you think you started to actually kind of settle down and begin to understand your role better as the SEAC? And how do you, what impact do you hope that you've left behind?
Well, as the SEAC, I think I had an advantage by being thrown in the joint machine early on. It must have been in E4, E5. So I started understanding. So basically the Air Force fostered me to the Army and the Navy, and they never claimed me back, you know? So I got to understand and learn from a lot of great leaders in there. And one of the key takeaways that I got from those relationships was the differences in cultures. What they value, what they didn't value. And then you start becoming a hybrid mechanism when it comes, this is the way that I'm gonna interact when I'm with the Army, this is what I need to do when I'm with the Navy. And that started shaping that joint mindset that is really needed to interoperate, because joint is not about becoming, it's about understanding. Understanding those cultures, those roles, their strengths, their weaknesses, and then as an airman, filling those gaps to make sure that you bring value to whatever mission is being tasked to that joint entity. I use my time with the Navy SEALs as an example. Now, clearly there's an expectation for physical training, there's an expectation for shooting, and many other things. But I wasn't brought into that SEAL team to be a door kicker. I was brought in that team to be the rescue expert. And if I couldn't do that better than anyone else, I was of no value to that team. And it was when they finally realized that I could not only be the rescue expert that they needed, but that I can hold my own weight when it came to shooting, when it came to PT, and all of the tactical things that they were doing, that I was accepted into that. But you had to continuously prove yourself in order to do that. So when I went with the Army, the same thing. When I went with the Navy, the same thing. But eventually it builds your credibility, and then you build a good name for yourself, and that's how you get invited to the dance every time. The dance meaning the fight.
So we have to kind of have that same kind of mindset that we have with the joint force as we do with our international partners and allies. Can you speak a little bit to the importance of security cooperation and what role that will play in the next fight?
So on the importance of security cooperation globally, I will use my time in United States AFRICOM as an example. We were underinvesting on NCO and petty officer development in Africa. Now, the budget for professional development was about 18.7 million, give or take, and we were only investing 1.2 million on enlisted. The rest was going into officer training. And I asked a simple question, well, what are we getting out of 1.2 million? And they're like, well, we're sending two Africans per year for the United States Army Sergeant's Major Academy. Huh, that's no good, that's no good. And the reason that's not good is because when you look at the history of conflict and instability in Africa, since the 1960s, 90% of the coups on the continent were enlisted forces overthrowing governments. Basically, troops that were disenchanted with their government, they were underpaid, underfed, undertrained, and they had no loyalty to their chain of command. So Warlord X will come out and say, hey, take your gun, come with me. We'll overthrow those guys, and then I'll go ahead and take care of you. And that was a vicious cycle. So I brought it up to the combatant commander and stated that, hey, unless we start putting more money and more effort into the NCO development, we're gonna have a lot of figureheads that they're gonna have forces that are bound to revolt on them. So we need to balance this. General Wohlhauser at the time agreed with the plan, and we instituted a development strategy to be able to go ahead and create more disciplined and loyal forces in Africa to be able to go ahead and take care of their citizens. And that process is still going today. So anybody that is thinking that one NCO cannot make a difference, we made a difference. And it wasn't just me. It was a core of about 26 NCOs in United States Africa Command that took this task, and they made it a reality. An everlasting reality that is creating a lot of professional forces in that continent.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference that a educated and well-funded enlisted corps makes to a organization?
Well, well-educated and trained force is a force multiplier. Now, we rely on officers to have the responsibility for making key decisions. But what we have found out since Vietnam, which by the way, it was at the tail end of Vietnam that we decided to open senior NCO academies or professional military education institutions, was because we saw the value of empowering and educating NCOs to take care of some of the roles that some of the junior officers were filling. Why? Because we're 80% of the force, give or take. So now as we continue to evolve into a more thinking force, we need to provide more education and training for enlisted forces to be autonomous and be able to go ahead and do what many officers cannot do via access or by restrictions. Using an example on that dynamic is what we did with Ukraine. Now, in 2014, the Russians invaded Ukraine and Crimea was annexed from Ukraine. The president of Ukraine at the time said, well, we're fighting an adversary with the same model that they use. So they know what our next move is because we're using Russian tactics. We need to flip that. We need to go ahead and take a more NATO-US approach to the way that we fight. And in 5 short years, they created military training institutions, basic training for officers and enlisted. They ended up revamping their entire special operations systems. And that is the force that you're seeing fighting Russia today. So there's a lot of value and there's a lot of proof. And there were a lot of countries that were paying close attention to that dynamic because they're like, if we don't catch up to that, we may be next in the pecking order. So we need to go ahead and invest more on NCOs. And that has been a very tough task or a very challenging task from my position as the SEAC to be able to travel worldwide and make sure that I inject in the key places where we need to make this happen.
You've had a long career with a whole lot of different assignments and different roles and responsibilities. What are some of the most notable ways that you've seen the Air Force and the Department of Defense change?
One of the most notable changes that I have seen in the 33 years I've been in service is the continuing process for the empowerment and access of the enlisted force. Empowerment, where NCOs are no longer looked as glorified first sergeants. You know, make sure that people have haircuts, shine boots, and so on, pick up cigarette butts, you know. NCOs are now more empowered to be autonomous on the battlefield. They're more empowered to represent their commanders when the commander cannot be present. And the reason that is possible is because they're allowing NCOs and petty officers more access to information that is going to help them think critically, strategically, in order to be able to advocate for the organization. So that will be the key thing that I have seen in over 33 years.
So you mentioned, you know, having an open mind, leading with an open mind, thinking critically and strategically. How can people start? What's the most important part to having that as a leader? And how can people start to build that and train their mind to be more open and think more critical?
It all boils down to one thing. Humility. You have to check your ego. Realize that you are given an opportunity to fill a position, but that position does not give you the right to think that you know it all. The reason you have a unit with different AFSCs, with different ranks and different responsibilities, is because you're trying to get the collective effort and diversity of thought from the entire organization to go ahead and make the mission happen. And as a leader, you have to be open to listen to every single one of those people. And humility is a cornerstone of that. That's what forces you to listen. You know, I always encourage people to listen before they speak and to think before they write. And the reason for that is because sometimes when you tend to rapid fire on things, you're acting upon your own bias. And sometimes that bias can be critical, sometimes detrimental to your credibility. So it's always imperative that leaders get in the habit of listening a lot more and speaking a lot less to understand the gaps and shortfalls that not only the organization has, but also themselves.
Can you speak a little to the importance of having credibility as the CEAC and like how that helps with your influence in the different rooms that you find yourself in?
Well, credibility plays out in a lot of ways, because if you are going to be the only enlisted person in the many forums that I'm invited, i.e. the tank. So the tank is where the Joint Chiefs go to make the critical decisions for the department. I am the only enlisted. They need to know and they need to trust that I'm going to add value, not time, to those meetings. Value because I'm well-versed on the topic that they're discussing. Value because I have listened to what every single one of you had to say about the particular issue. And three, because I'm not only going to provide the information, but I'm going to provide solutions to the problem that are going to resonate with the force, and resonate with the force in a sense to where they're going to be motivated to go and kill anyone that actually gets in our way. It is that simple. It's nothing more. The military is all about war fighting. Everything else that we do is a bonus. But at the end of the day, every single one of you has to put on a uniform and maybe take up arms based on the oath that you took to be able to affect the instrument of war for the United States of America. So that credibility, being a war fighter myself, actually speaks volumes when you're in a room. And you have to make sure that you're not the one that loves to listen yourself speak, because that turns a lot of people off. When I open my mouth, it is to do just that, add value, not time.
So how do you balance that idea of, you know, bolstering your credibility by adding value with the idea that maybe you could fail, maybe you could mess something up, maybe you could say the wrong thing at the wrong time? And what advice do you have for people who are trying to find their voice and kind of that middle ground?
Well, I fail all the time. I'm not immune to it. Nobody is. And that is part of humility, once again. Realizing that sometimes you're gonna get it right, sometimes you're gonna get it wrong. But credibility is money in the bank. The more things you get right, the more money you have. And every once in a while, you're gonna screw up and you're gonna have to make a withdrawal. But at the end of the day, the balance on this side has gotta remain high for people to continue to believe in you, right? So courage is another thing. If you're thinking that you're gonna be a leader and you're not gonna fail, or you're gonna go ahead and play it safe and not do enough for fear of failure, you're gonna lose them. They're gonna be looking at you as somebody that is just a careerist, that is just willing to play it safe. And when you do fail, own it. Own it. And then analyze the position that you were in, the shortfalls and the gaps, and then discuss it with them about, all right, so this is how I got it wrong. How do you think we can fix it? I've always been in the habit of bringing my team to be able to provide that perspective. So again, that collaboration, that teamwork, and putting our heads together really works to it. And if they see you actually being open about your failures, they will be open too. But I have known many leaders that tried to put this persona, which is fake from the beginning. You can smell it a mile away. Well, you know, I'm clean on this. No, you're not. I'm pretty sure that if we were to dig deep into you, we'll find many failures in there. You're just sugarcoating them. So I never decided to do that. So anybody that is listening, don't be afraid to fail. That is part of learning, and that is part of having courage. Leadership is not easy, and it's not something that you can test your way into, all right? It's not something that one award is gonna give you the right to go ahead and lead. And it's not something that the longer you stay, the likelihood it is for you to go ahead and have the honor to lead people. And I always spend down three things that are probably the most challenging things that you can do as a leader, but they are necessities. And the first one is to employ the lazy. It's really easy to take care of the rock stars in the organization, right? I mean, they will do whatever you ask them to do. But somewhere in that organization, there's the quiet, shy one that has not been given the opportunity or the motivation to tap into their full potential. So that is task number one. The second one is to inspire the forgotten. The ones that nobody talks to, the one that are the oddballs of the organization, for you to take the time as a leader to go over there and spend time with them, get them out of their shell, and make them feel part of the organization is critical to teamwork. And then the last one, which is the easiest one, is just to really seek out the best performers and make sure that they get promoted to do something better for the organization. And I say that that's the easy one because that pull is going to be very evident. And I'm not talking about the ass kissers, all right? I'm talking about the people that are actually packing the mail, the quiet professionals of the organization that are actually doing everything that they're supposed to be doing, that are working in the shadows because they're not doing it for self-gratification or self-promotion. They're doing it because they care about the mission. Those are the ones that you have to really focus on to make sure that they keep moving forward and create the best possible chiefs for the United States Air Force in our case, or senior enlisted leaders for the total force. So those are three things that I encourage everyone to do as a leader.
Anything else? I don't want to cut it off. I'm taking mental notes, so.
Is there one nugget you would leave the total force with, Siak? Out of your 33-ish years, what would you leave?
Well, I mean, there's many nuggets or silver bullets that you can leave people, and I already left 20 on a piece of paper back in 2012. But what I would like to tell the force is that to be chosen as their SEAC has been an absolute honor and a privilege. To be able to be your advocate and your voice for the last 4 years has been a phenomenal experience and a fight that has been worthy every breathing second of the day. So I would like to say thank you for your support. We haven't always agreed on things, but that is life. And at the end of the day, we got to look at the score sheet. Are we ready to go ahead and kick somebody's ass? And the answer is always got to be yes, because that is really what we're designed to do. We're warriors first. And the only thing that matters is just to make sure that we're trained, ready, and able to bring that fight to the enemy.
As we bring the interview closer to a close, do you think that you will continue to mentor or find another way to help the Joint Force as you transition out of your position as the SEAC?
Absolutely. When you feel this positions, basically the E-10s, because there's like seven E-10s, they're calling E-9 plus because DFAS was lazy and they didn't want to put the E-10 line on the pay table. When you fill these positions, there's an expected lifelong commitment to the force. And it's not something that is forced upon you, it's something that is ingrained in your heart because you care about the troops. All the way until my last dying breath, I'm going to be doing something to make sure you guys are set up for success. Whether it's providing advice, whether it's working with industry to get you the best equipment, whether it's advising people to make sure that they have the proper mechanisms to better train and take care of you, we all do that. You know, Kay Wright is doing it right now with the Air Force Aid Society. I'm pretty sure that Joe Bass is going to do it when she retires. But it's not because we want to make money. It's because we care about this. And it's because of that oath. That oath means a lot to every single one of us. And I hope that every single one of you takes that oath seriously, because it is the biggest promise that you're gonna make in your entire life.
I know, I watched one talk that you gave at the Air Force Academy, I believe, and they asked you about, you know, all the naysayers throughout your career and the different parts where you had messed up as a junior airman. Do you think that that junior airman would believe where you're sitting today?
Hell no. No, I joke and I say hell no, but you have to remember that when you're a 19-year-old and you're trying to figure out your way into life, I mean, you have several targets that you want to meet. And one target was to not get a second Article 15 and get kicked out. The other target was this thing called pararescue. Then the next target was to become a chief. Then after that, against my will, was to become a command chief. And eventually things just play out. And I took it one day at a time because there's no more important time than the present. Can't do anything about the past except for learn from your failures. Can't predict the future. So right now is the time where you can make a difference. So don't waste it. Tomorrow is not guaranteed. And trust me, I've seen many people in combat that didn't get that tomorrow. So how dare we fail them when we have the opportunity to still make a difference?
That does it for this episode of At Altitude. My thanks to SEAC Ramon Colon Lopez and all the soldiers, sailors, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, airmen, and guardians he represents, who provide the fighting ability and deterrence to keep all challengers at bay. The At Altitude podcast is a production of Airman Magazine, headquartered at Defense Media Activity in Fort Meade, Maryland. You can find all of our content at airmanmagazine.af.mil, or you can look for us on Divids, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Until next time.